tomorrow and ask questions to him.
Who else do we have here?
Then we have, and we would just move down to here.
Mm-hmm.
And just start on our list. We have, three representatives from Colleen Collins, so I could be in session with you. The problem is, she's clerking Collins from the floor and looking down to us.
Yeah, that'd be great. Otherwise, I'll get lost.
Okay.
Well, convene the subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Rules and Elections, and we have as first order of business executive appointments, and I'm going to invite Mike Smith to come forward on his appointment to Government Standards and Practices Commission. Mike, we've had the pleasure of meeting you previously.
Yes.
To tell, for the record here, why you're interested in this.
Okay. My name is Mike Smith, for the record. I'd just like to start off by thanking you for the opportunity to have this confirmation hearing. I'm truly honored to be considered for this appointment to the Government Standards and Practices Commission. When I was first approached about this appointment, I honestly didn't know a great deal about this commission. I did a little research, and I met with Pat Hearn to try and get a feel for what the commission does and how I could be of service. I was fortunate enough to get to sit down a couple of commission meetings. In fact, I attended one earlier this morning. There I got a feel for the type of issues the commission faces. And frankly, I was surprised at how few offenses there were. I think that says good things about the vast majority of government employees, lobbyists, and elected representatives. I also met with the chair and several members of the committee, and many of you offered me more insight and solidified my desire to join the commission. As my resume reflects, my background is in engineering. I've worked as a structural engineer since I graduated from the University of Portland in May of 96. When I thought if I'd be able to contribute to the commission, I must be honest, I'm prejudiced with my profession. I think engineers always are an asset to have around. Although I'm not schooled in law, I do understand logic, and I will work diligently to be a contributing member of the commission. I learned many lessons in school. The most important one was that hard work can make up for any disadvantage. Any disadvantage I possess, not being an expert in law, I will make up for with effort. The mission of this commission is protecting the public trust. In a time of cynicism, the work of the Government Standards and Practices Commission is more important than ever. And unfortunately, we do live in a cynical world. I still have a lot to learn about this commission and what it means to serve the public. But as a commissioner with a duty to protect the public trust, I can guarantee you I will bring my best efforts to this.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
I do have two.
Oh, good.
I think it's real unfortunate that we don't have more of our members here so that they might meet you and publicly have the opportunity of grilling you. But knowing that you've been a recent candidate for public office, do you feel that in any way that there's conflict and in a public official or one who's aspiring to be a public official or serving on this commission?
I don't think that there's a conflict. In fact, I think it brings something to the table that's going to be nice to have at the commission. Being someone who has run for public office, you get a feel for how quickly allegations can turn ugly and how important it is to be sure what you're doing and the actions you pursue part of the commission are well-grounded. So I think that rather than being a detriment, if anything, it would be an asset to the commission to have people who have served as public officials or who have run as candidates.
Mm-hmm. Might be not be a fair question, but would would you be planning or thinking about continuing your aspirations to serve in state government in the near future? Is this, in fact, some kind of a stepping stone to that possibility?
This does present me an opportunity to serve, since I did lose the election. I couldn't figure out why my wife was so supportive of me getting on the commission after I told her that I was planning to get on, but then I realized that if you're elected, an elected official can't be on the commission. So I'm sure, being the smarter of the two of us, she sees this as an opportunity to keep me from running again, if anything.
Well, it's at least pretty well known that you ran a very vigorous yet candidate-friendly sort of campaign, and I personally can't think of any commanding reason why you couldn't do a job in serving the public here. My sense is that we would have been well served if other members would have had a chance to meet you and question you. Do you have any questions?
I don't. I think Kate Brown will be here momentarily, so we will have a quorum.
Okay.
So if we
will, when I get called next door.
All right. I apologize too. We just finished the judiciary, so that's why we're a little short-handed this morning.
All righty. Well, you have no questions?
I have no questions.
Thank you.
Appreciate you
showing up. And with that, we're going to close the, I opened a work session, but I couldn't do that. I was in a subcommittee and could only take testimony. So we're going to close the testimony portion. And thank you for coming before us. We have before us Senate Bill 831. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 831. Invite John Mangus and Jack Magnuson. Oh, okay. He's got
a half. What's this mean?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Mangus, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 831. 831 basically would allow all veterans a one-time shot at job preference in public employment for a period of 15 years from date of separation from active duty. And what that does is it changes it from the current law where the preference is only allowed after service, if you entered the service after 1976, if you served in a spot where forces were engaged with an armed enemy or a terrorist activity. It would also allow disabled veterans to use the preference more than one time, and it would remove the current 15 years from date of discharge restriction on the disabled veteran. It would allow all disabled veterans to use the preference on promotional tests, and the background of Senate Bill 831 is the result of efforts by the Veterans Groups, United Veterans Groups of Oregon, the Department of Administrative Services, and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. Mr. Magnuson here has served as chairman of the Governor's Advisory Committee to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and also the United Veterans Group of Oregon as the legislative chairman for the American Legion Department of Oregon.
Chair?
Yes.
Brian. How many people would this affect, and what would be the impact?
Chair, Senator Bryant, I really don't know. Actually, very few. You see the numbers go up during a wartime period, like Vietnam, and that happened to last for a lot of years, and so there was a lot of use by Vietnam veterans. But since 1976, the number of veterans entering the service has been reduced dramatically, and it's only today that you see the number of veterans that are going into the area to support operations in the Balkans or the Desert Storm program. I couldn't give you a good number without just not telling you the truth. I don't think there's any estimates by DAS either.
And Mr. Chair, a definition of veteran, is that include Reserve National Guard, or is it only active duty?
It's only active duty, Senator Ryan.
And again, Mr. Chair,
yes.
How much of a active duty do you need to serve in order to be considered a veteran?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant, Oregon law requires the 90-day period of active duty on the definition of a veteran, which is different than what's required under the Veterans Home Loan Program. I would mention that if a reservist or a National Guard member was activated, which you see a lot of today, and sent to an assignment in Europe in support of operations, that person would then become eligible. But the person that the traditional reservist that attends meetings on a monthly basis and 2 weeks annual training, and the initial basic training and advanced training would not qualify.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Jack Magnuson, spokesman for the United Veterans Groups of Oregon and legislative chairman of the American Legion Department of Oregon. The UGVO represents some 13 veterans organizations, and I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 831. Veterans should get a fair chance at civil service jobs in Oregon. This bill provides for eligible veterans who served after October 1576 to be given preference on civil service examinations. Many veterans sought a career in the armed forces, but due to the downsizing, they were forced to get out of the military service. This would help those people obtain jobs in a workforce they had not planned to enter until a later time. We all recognize the sacrifice that veterans have made for their country. We need to recognize those sacrifices, and this is a meaningful way of doing that. After my service discharge, I took 2 civil service examinations and was accorded a veteran's preference. While I didn't accept employment, this was a nice benefit to have had I not secured other employment. This law needs to be brought up to date, and I urge the committee to support this bill. I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions. And before I do that, we concur with Amendment 1 by the Legal Council of Oregon Cities and Counties to be inserted. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bratt, a question on the meaning on line 16 of a uniform method by which special consideration is given. Do you know what the current method is or what you have in mind as far as the uniform method?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bryant, I do not know, except that I think it's an examination process.
Is it done by rule? Jack, please. Yes. Sometimes the Veterans Administration or somebody might adopt a rule rather than a statute on what that method is.
Filled out here.
Yeah.
Completely.
That's intended to be the uniform method.
Mm-hmm. It's just a 5% preference.
Probably, yeah. In drafting this, then we should make some reference to what that is, because by not having the tie-in, at least the question as to whether or not we're talking about another uniform method.
Is that not correct? The uniform method is what's spelled out here for your giving a 5% preference.
And that's the only uniform method we're talking about. So the reference that I just specified on line 16 is really referring back to the earlier section of the bill. I'm getting nods. That's correct. All right. Thank you.
All righty. No further questions. Thank you very much. And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 831, and we'll move on to a public hearing on House Bill 2657. John Chandler. Did John, you just... Your satchel got misplaced. He found something here.
This is the wrong bill, isn't it, Chairman?
Wrong bill?
Yes. The only guy here about blazer tickets, I'm holding up the potatoes. If you wouldn't mind moving on to the next bill, Mr. Chairman, I'll go get my... I'm going to put my head in the brick and I'll be back in.
Okay.
That's a bill from next door.
Yes, it is.
That's a good bill, though.
Very good bill.
Thank you very
much. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2657, open the public hearing on House Bill 2964. And we have several folks signed up here. We're going to ask Jack Linhart to come forward.
Mm-hmm.
And we've did you get your all right.
So, Chairman and three members, my name is Jack Linhart, owner of the airport at Hubbard, about halfway to Portland. I passed out a letter for you, and I won't take time to read that. In brief, I started crop spraying 44 years ago. I started by hand pumping fuel from 55-gallon barrels into the airplanes. Later, I went to a fuel truck. Eventually, I installed an underground tank system with pumps at a gas island that we would taxi up to and fuel. A few years ago, we were forced to take out this system because of environmental laws, take out the tanks and piping, all everything, and start over again. So we went back to fuel trucks again, and they've not had a problem with fuel in all of these 44 years with anything that would be even approaching anything dangerous. We ground our trucks. We take care of the static electricity so it doesn't occur. We top load. We visually watch when the fuel is transferred. We feel like these laws are overkill. They've been in existence for a lot of years, but they were not enforced until there were some personality problems. There was a little squabble down in Lebanon between a couple of competitors, and this brought everything to light. That's the reason for this issue right now. Once they brought up the issue to the fire marshal's office, then they go, aha, they have a law. It's never enforced. Well, they never needed it, but now they decided because of the squabble they were forced to. And this law would ask that we come out from under that because we really don't have the problem. Other small airports all up and down the valley, I know most of the operators during all of these years, they've had no problems either. So I would just highly recommend that you give a new pass recommendation to the Senate floor on this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony and questions. Thank you. We have Roger Severson, and Jim Everett.
Mr. Chair, I'm Roger Severson. I'm with the State Fire Marshal's Office. I'm with the Codes and Technical Services Unit. We understand and have a very strong feeling for what's going on with a lot of the industry and the smaller airports within the state of Oregon. There has been quite a problem with some fuel delays and shutoffs in some cases because of the process in which those fuels are being transferred. What we're really concerned for, though, at this time is that rather than to adjust that rule or fix the code as we are then through some process prior to, in fact, any of these instances, being aware that there's some regulation that needs some updating. We have had committees working on this. We're working in that direction to make allowances where right now both the national codes and the Uniform Fire Code that's adopted by the state do not allow a truck-to-truck fuel. It just hasn't been in the process, and it has not been one that's been allowed. We believe that can be done. We believe that working with industry that we can make some arrangements and put that into code that could allow, under certain safeguards and distances, setbacks, exposure problems, and public safety, that we can make some arrangements for fueling from truck-to-truck operations as opposed to the way the codes read today. We had started into some committees on that some time back, and unfortunately, in the middle of that time, these other incidents have occurred, as was shared by the other speaker a minute ago. And in that process, apparently it was decided that rather than continue to work within a committee environment towards changing code and making something that would work with some common ground, it was at that time decided to write a bill rather than to work in that committee and eliminate the rules. From the State Fire Marshal's Office, we're just real concerned that we might not overshoot the whole process if we eliminate regulation altogether within many of these airports. And the way this bill was amended in the House, it now would include the elimination of fire regulations for fuel truck transfer in all the airports within the state of Oregon, short of eight, and those being those commercial passenger service scheduled flight type locations. There was a statement made within that that common sense should be allowed to prevail, but we know throughout our history that has been one of the major issues that caused us to write the codes that we do today, is because common sense does not always do the job. As much as we'd like to see that happen, we truly do not want to be an over-regulatory agency, as we seem to be deemed at times, but there are reasons that we have to have some minimum standards, and we still think for public safeguards that we'd like to work in that direction. We did hold a neutral position early on in the House, but with that amendment now going towards all those airports other than eight, we feel we have to stand and oppose this regulation for life safety purposes. I'd be glad to answer any questions. And Jim Everett is here to also share with you issues about NFPA and regulations that are how they're developed on a national level. And we're not just, these aren't made up rules or laws that we're doing just for Oregon or just for within this area.
Sir Brian, you mentioned you had this committee that was working on this for, I think you said, two or three years?
About a year prior to.
And how far have they gotten? Do you have proposed rules?
We have some draft language that was coming close towards being ready for some publication for the purpose of scrutiny again with subcommittee members, but that's about where we were when...
What did the proposed rules do?
What it would do... my book's in the back. Basically, what it's going... That's okay. What it's going to do is provide some setbacks, distances. It would discuss transfer distances between vehicles. It would discuss the types of valving that would be required for bottom load types, filling. pretty much that, and there may be a few other items that I can give you specifically that draft, but I didn't bring that as part of your testimony.
Well, the reason I mention it is, obviously, you're close to the way the pain growth bill reads now. We'll be in session for a few more weeks. We always have the option of codifying rules, and you seem to recognize there's a problem with the existing law. If you have something that would clarify and fix this, that is an option to what's being proposed. Now is the time to propose it. And I realize the rules process goes a little slower, but I think it's possible through a phone conference to talk to whoever's involved in this and get back to the committee and say, here's what we would support in a bill.
Chairman Starr and Senator Bryan, I'd be very happy to, I'm not sure it's polished yet, but I think for the purposes of, as you suggest, I would be very happy to submit to any subcommittee or group at least the draft we have to this point and let them review that, and we can be certainly open still yet to further common ground direction with it. It's still in the works, and we understand that.
This bill has made its way through the House committee and through the House vote, and now it's in our position. We can sit on it for a while, but I would admonish you to bring that information forward, because we will not sit on it long, and chances are that it could pass in its present form if we don't have some language that would help us to understand why we should alter it. In the meantime, let's hear from our friend from Portland.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bryant, Jim Everett, I have been with the City of Portland for 23 years and currently sit as the Western Regional Chair for the National Fire Protection Association, and also sit as Chair for the Oregon Fire Marshal Association ISTE chapter. I've been involved with co-development for more years than I care to remember. The point that I'd like to make about co-development in general is, if we take a look at NFPA documents, which most of this is based upon, especially the NFPA 385, which is the standard for tank vehicles and flammable and combustible liquids, if you take a look at the consensus process for the development of these national codes, of the members, 16 members that sit and develop this code, only two are fire officials. The remaining members, okay, are members of product management, flammable liquid, DuPont, etc., manufacturers of equipment, which have a liability issue in the use of this equipment, the insurance industry, and the Department of Transportation. So it's not the Fire Bureau, really, that have any control over the issue. It's industry that's driving it, not the fire service. We act as consultants and try and work on a historical basis to work with industry, but we are 1/8 of the whole committee, and it's a consensus process. Everybody has an equal say in the development of these codes. So to break away from the standard, okay, kind of takes away from the fact that industry has had a fair share at a national basis. Okay, actually, as fire service, we can't afford to send a lot of people to work on these codes. So we're a minority in the development. The other thing that I'd like to bring out is, by overriding or going away from national code consensus, we're setting a dangerous precedent. One, taking power away from the fire marshal as rulemaking authority, and two, if we look at all the national codes that deal with fuel dispensing, there is NFPA 1, NFPA 30, 30A, 52 for compressed natural gas, National Fuel Gas Code, Standard for Liquefied Natural Gas, Liquefied Petroleum Gas Code, National Electrical Code, which deals with bonding issues and safety regarding electricity during fuel dispensing, the Standard Edition for Repair Garage, NFPA 88, 101 Life Safety Code, NFPA 122, addition for standard for fire protection and control of underground metal and non-metal mines. NFPA 402, additional guide for aircraft rescue and firefighting operations. All these cover fuel regulations. So if you take part of this puzzle away, okay, I'm concerned that this is setting a precedent that could come back and make the job of fire prevention extremely difficult. And I've known and worked with the state for more years than
1520, since before the adoption of the National Code locally. And I assure you that we make every effort to deal with industry, talk with them on a fair basis, and try and make concessions and work where we can. But national standards is promulgated by the industry and the manufacturer of equipment for us to overturn that. They're saying this is the safe way to operate their equipment. And that kind of puts us in a bind. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Questions?
We're going to have no further questions this morning. But yes.
Well, Chairman of the car, what I will do is I'll get out and make a copy of that draft I have right now and get it back to you. You just use that as you wish, and if you'd like to develop another committee or someone to review that, or a telephone conference call, if that was as suggested, I'd be happy to work with you on those issues.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For that, we're going to recess the hearing on House Bill 2964. The we have we now have a quorum, and we're going to open a work session on our executive appointment.
Mr. Chairman?
Yep. We recommend the approval of the appointment of Mike Smith to the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. Senator Miller has moved that we move the appointment Mike Smith to the Government Standards and Practices Commission, the floor with recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Any comment, any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant?
Aye.
Senator Miller?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, Mike Smith has been, appointment has been moved to the floor with the recommendation the appointment be confirmed. Senator Miller.
Sure.
You chair that one. Thank you. With that, we close the work session on executive appointments and move to a work session on Senate Bill 831. Senator Miller.
I'd move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 831.
Senator Miller has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 831. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller.
I would move Senate Bill 831 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Miller has moved Senate Bill 831 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator McBride.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Senator
Scott. Aye. I received the necessary majority. Senate Bill 831 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry. We will be working with the House just to clarify that our intent on that
the uniform method is the one that's referred to in some paragraph one.
Right. With that, we're going to close that work session. And we have drafting and major introduction. We have a bill before us.
We have a request.
What is the request?
That the Senate Rules and Elections Committee requests that a bill to require create a school performance report card for every Oregon school. This bill be drafted and subsequently introduced as a Rules and Elections Committee bill.
Chair would entertain a motion.
I move that we introduce the LC draft as reference. LC draft.
Yeah.
Committee drafting request dated 5/21. Senator Miller has moved that we approve the committee drafting request dated
5/20. You might want to do that 5/20 since 5/21 hasn't happened yet. Yes.
Thank you. Any objections? So ordered. We have Representative Wilson with us, and we're going to open a public hearing again on our House Bill 2964.
Chair Starr and members of the committee, a member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you on House Bill 2964. Extreme instances call for some extreme measures sometimes, and I want to say that I think we all respect the rulemaking capability of state agencies and wish that it would move and be more responsive sometimes, and that's why I bring this bill forward. Problem is, in my district, I'm trying to get fuel shipments restored permanently to a small airport in my district that is currently under the sword of Damocles, which is scheduled to fall, I believe, in December. They're operating in a grace period right now provided by the state fire marshal's office, but when that period of time comes, fuel shipments will once again be cut off, not only to the Illinois Valley, the Cave Junction Airport, the one that I'm concerned with, but also small airports in Prineville, Ashland, Aurora, Lebanon, and Malala. These small airports are airports that fuel airplanes directly out of their own fuel trucks. They do not have elaborate fuel storage or dispensing systems. They don't have the money to build such facilities. That's the problem here. Last year, the state fire marshal's office abruptly began enforcing a rule that had largely been ignored for many years, and that rule requires that vehicles that are used in the fueling of airplanes only receive their fuel at these approved storage and pumping facilities. Now, again, these small airports can't afford these capital improvements. For my airport especially, it's absolutely and totally out of reach. For years, these small airports have been successfully receiving their fuel from a fuel distributor here in the Willamette Valley. And that distributor drives to the airfield and pumps fuel directly into the airfield's fueling truck. And this is not a new practice, and it's not a reckless practice, because this very kind of truck-to-truck transfer has been going on since the birth of aviation. This bill states that the fire marshal will be prohibited from regulating transfer of aircraft fuel from a fuel distributor's tank vehicle to an aircraft refueling vehicle. I'm talking to the fuel distributor here in Salem. The owner told me that his company operates under very, very strict guidelines. They're not at all uncomfortable in doing deliveries like these because, after all, they've been doing them for a very, very long time. And they are regulated by two things that frankly concern them a lot more than the presence of the state fire marshal's rules and the Uniform Fire Code, and that would be, number one, safety for their own people, and so they operate under their own company safety code, and number two, their insurance company has a stringent code that they would not dare abridge. And so for those two reasons alone, the presence of the Uniform Fire Code and what it says regarding this is, I don't want to say inconsequential, but it's certainly wallpaper. It's in the background. So again, these small airports cannot afford these fuel packs. Just can't do it. And so I'm really proposing this bill to allow the fuel to begin flowing to these rural airports once again as soon as this stay is over, this grace period is over. And I'm not sure about the other airports, but for mine, it's over, I do believe, in the month of December. So they've done their best to comply, and the fire marshal's office has worked with them to give them this period of time, but at the end of this grace period, it's over for them once again. I know the bill may at first blush seem to be reckless, but again, truck-to-truck transfer is something that has been going on for eons and is certainly nothing new, and I think all I would have to do is point to the number of fires, explosions, calamities that have occurred in these years that the fire marshal's office hasn't been paying attention to this process, and I think you'll have a hard time finding anything. So thank you very much.
Earlier, the
fire marshal's office testified that they were neutral on the first bill, but as amended now oppose it, and that they're in a rulemaking process that's been going on for some time. My concern is that if they end up opposing the bill, there's the risk of veto. And my question would be, have you talked to the governor's office about what his position would be on this yet? Or if you are concerned with the veto, are you interested in codifying what their draft rules are in regards to this? And I have not read the rules. I've just been handed to me for the first time.
Senator Bryant, in response to your question, I have not talked to the governor's office to find out what they think about this particular bill. I want to say again, although I appreciate the rulemaking process, I have no faith that anything will happen to remediate the problem at my airport or any of these others by the time the fuel has to stop again. And so I would be willing to negotiate and do anything that I thought would work to make this happen by December, but I just have no confidence that anything will happen without attempting to pass a bill in this legislature.
And my thought would be, and I know nothing about this issue, but the two pages of draft rules, I don't know if they're reasonable or unreasonable, but it might be a basis of amendment to the bill that would satisfy your concern and also obtain the governor's signature. So I just point that out as an option.
Senator Bryant, thank you for your comment, and I would be happy to look over those draft rules, and I would appreciate the committee hanging on to this bill, and I'd love to have some input after looking at these.
Okay, I'll pass that on to the chair. I apologize for the chair and vice chair leaving. Revenue is also meeting at this time. They're balancing between meetings.
I'm sure they are. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have other witnesses on this bill?
Okay. As I understand it, then that Representative Wilson was our last witness on House Bill 2464. It's 2964. Is that correct? No one's raising their hand running up here. So we will close the public hearing, open the public hearing as a subcommittee. Can we see if John Chandler can do any better than his first attempt on House Bill 2657? You know, it is getting late in the day, and I don't know what you've been doing this afternoon, but
Mr. Chairman, I had a dang good bill up next door, and I was just so excited about it, I couldn't help but tell another committee about it as well. For the record, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 2657. I actually have the right written testimony.
Oh,
here you go. This bill deals with the issue of construction excise taxes. As it deals with the issue, it prohibits them. There are two jurisdictions. This is a form of dealing with them. There are two jurisdictions that state currently impose excise taxes on construction activity, City of Canby, City of Fairview. Both of those are grandfathered by this bill. And the reason we brought the bill forward is quite simple. The written testimony indicates there's a number of ways local government can use the construction industry as a source of revenue. The one that predominantly is system development charges, which go towards new infrastructure. Excise taxes that are currently allowed under Oregon law can be imposed upon the privilege of construction activity with absolutely no connection back to the demands placed by that activity on the infrastructure of the community. The bill originally was drafted with the intention of allowing construction excise taxes so long as they are treated like an impact fee. But after a couple of rounds through ledge council, it became obvious that there was really no way to draft that in such a way that it didn't just tangle the system development charge statute up beyond recognition. And so the bill was amended in the House to simply prohibit the excise taxes, grandfather those that are currently in existence, and go on from there. On the House floor, the statement was made, and we certainly support this, that this is not an attempt by the industry to avoid paying our share. We believe this is open charge process is the fair way to go about doing that. It is, however, an attempt on our part to avoid being seen as a source of ready cash for local government. In the two jurisdictions which are being grandfathered, one imposes an excise tax of up to, I believe, $2 a square foot for the privilege of constructing a home in that jurisdiction, and the money goes into the city general fund. The other imposes an excise tax for the purpose of constructing a city hall. While we have nothing against general fund or city halls, we don't believe necessarily that's a proper role for our industry to be asked to play. This bill passed the House by a vote of 42 to 15. The cities and counties, while not thrilled about it, put on no active opposition. We would certainly appreciate this committee moving on to the Senate floor with a due pass. Be glad to take any questions.
Mr. Chair, I'm delighted to report that Mr. Chandler this time is testifying on the correct bill.
And Mr. Chairman, I feel we're in line to abuse me. I don't have to be in here.
Appreciate that.
Brian's just mad that I watched him play shuffleboard the other night.
Oh, yes. I've blocked that out of my mind. That was terrible. He is the only witness on this bill.
All right. Well, we're going to have to...
Mr. Chairman, I just take
another witness. Oh, we have another witness.
Another witness?
Yes.
Come forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here representing the Oregon Remodeler Association, and we stand alongside the home builders on this issue because we found that we get swept in. The bill really was directed at new construction, but they never limited to new construction. They take us in, even though the rationale is for increased use, which would come from new construction. And because we get swept into something where we shouldn't be, we just assume not have to deal with it and have a law prohibiting it.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to close the hearing.
Nice work. House Bill 2657.
And we open a public hearing on House Bill 3035, Ian Gross, Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is indeed my pleasure and honor to be here before the distinguished members of the committee. And I appreciate your indulgence in holding hearing. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from District 37. We have a very, very simple bill before you today. That will, I believe, is a very fair compromise to this continuing saga of argument over who has authority over administrative rules. What we're proposing here is really just a very, very simple change in regard to when an agency gets ready to write a rule. They go out to their normal procedures of holding public hearings, and before they adopt the rule, if the rule needs to be reviewed at the request of a constituent or a legislator, the appropriate committee that would hear that bill would have an opportunity to review the rule before adoption. And by appropriate committee, I mean the appropriate legislative committee. And there are provisions in here in regard to 49 days before the effective date of the adoption of the rule, a committee would be convened, which would give us time, if it's during the interim, for the appropriate committees to have an opportunity to look at the rule. They have no ability to change the rule. All they can do is review the agency's record of their public comments, both written and oral, and have an opportunity to comment to the agency on the proposed rule. There is no enforcement. Obviously, that's an issue that continues to go before us in terms of constitutional separation of powers. But what we're doing here is just allowing policy input into what is essentially a contested rule before it's adopted. And hopefully, that will save the state and the taxpayers a great deal of money over time in regards to litigation that results from from rules that are challenged under the current system that we have today. It's really all we're asking is a very simple policy change to allow a legislative committee, once a rule has been proposed for adoption and ready to go to adoption, that they would have an opportunity to take a look at it if requested. We're not going to be looking at 2,800 administrative rules that the agencies adopted last year. We're only talking about rules that are requested to be reviewed at the request of either a constituent or a legislator.
Thank you very much. We've had I don't know what testimony you had in the House, but we had a request from the Department of Administrative Services that we might consider a 35-day period instead of a 49-day period. Was that debated and discussed?
No, Mr. Chair, it was not. I received that letter from them also just recently, and I understand their concern. I guess I have a similar concern, but however, in the opposite direction, in regard to the issue of interim committees and 49 days seems to be a reasonable length of time, in my view anyway, to allow a legislative committee to come together to review this rule. I think the shorter the time, I think it might be more difficult for that to occur. And I would refer to, he isn't like this, but to Mr. Chamoff, to if he would like to add anything in that regard from his perspective. If he has any further thoughts on that.
Mr. Chair, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council. The 49-day period was in the original bill, and it was there based on our best estimate of the time that the Office of Legislative Council would need to review proposed rules and report them to the committees. And I believe the 49 days stayed in the bill in its current and the engrossed form at the suggestion of Representative Cruz, who believed that was an appropriate period of time for the substantive committees to do their review.
We don't have anyone here from DAS to talk to us about this. Don't have a committee here. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I thank you both for your input. I appreciate it, and we'll take it under advisement, and perhaps we'll have a committee after this. We're going to rest at ease here a moment until, what's this? Okay, we're going to open the subcommittee public hearing on House Bill 2585. And Pat Hearn here. Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Pat.
My name is Pat Hearn. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. When House Bill 2585 first appeared, my commission was very concerned
did not take any position on it, but said, let's watch and see what happens. The bill that finally passed out of the House and came over here as A engrossed was approved. Since that A engrossed bill has been printed, I've had an opportunity to present some suggested amendments to Representative Mannix. He and I, in fact, discussed them an hour or so ago, and I think we're pretty much in agreement on some things that would get 2585 to a point where it, I'm not sure I should say supported or endorsed, but at least let's say it wouldn't be opposed by the Government Standards and Practices Commission. The commission met this morning and did ask me to convey to you one thing above all else, and that is that they hoped that the general constituent interest, that is the public interest of disclosure of conflicts of interest maintains its place in thought and consideration, and that they would be very concerned about any legislation which would reduce the level of public disclosure of conflicts of interest.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant, is this bill based upon the Attorney General's opinion that was issued by Hardy Myers 2 or 3 months ago?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant, I don't think it entirely is. I think part of it may be. But there was another bill that came out of the House that specifically was in response to that. It's a different bill.
Yeah, do you know where that bill is?
I'm sorry, Senator Bryant, I don't.
The reason I ask, Mr. Chair, is I've seen the draft of the other bill. I haven't seen this one before. It came up today. So, but I know Representative Mannix had also a keen interest in this.
Representative Mannix has been invited and is only supposed to be on his way. And would be my desire that you would continue to work with him and see if we can find a meeting place.
Mr. Chair, I'll certainly make that effort.
Thank you very much. No further questions. I'm going to recess the public hearing on this bill, and we'll wait while we're waiting for the arrival of Representative Mannix to move on to some other issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to open work session on House Bill 3035. We've taken testimony on that, and it's my desire to see that move forward. Would I move
House Bill 3035 and growth to the floor with the due path recommendation?
Senator Bryant has moved House Bill 3035 and growth to the floor with the due path recommendation. Any discussion? Any comments? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Senator Scott.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 3035, being gross, moved to floor of the Duke pass. And have a volunteer to carry.
I'll be happy to carry if someone gives me a script, since I missed the brilliant testimony of the need and reason for the bill.
Thank you very much. And we'll close that work session. Move to work session on House Bill 2657. That one, we've had testimony on in public hearing today from representing the Oregon Building Association, John Chandler, and Stephen Tafori representing the Oregon Remodelers Association, in agreement that we should move this bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2657 to the floor for your pass recommendation.
House Bill 2627, Senator Bryant has moved. 2657 has been moved by Senator Bryant to the floor for your pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator, may I inquire, since I was off next door, was there any adverse testimony? Any adverse testimony?
No adverse testimony.
Cities and counties, they just thought this was great?
They chose not to oppose it. Ms. Chandler said that some of them are not wild about it. The two cities that have it right now, and why I think in part he was so successful, is that the money that they collect from the construction enterprise tax, one goes into the general fund for the purposes, the other one is used to build a city hall. And so the feeling of the House was that the system development charges are a sufficient obligation to impose on new construction, and the funds that are used for that are appropriate. It just hasn't been. But they grandfathered the two that exist now.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Kamire.
I've never actually seen this one, but I'm not sure how they do it, but in a general rule, I think I will be opposing this just in terms of precluding with the general purpose government from being able to figure out what they can do with the consent of their citizens.
Thank you. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryan?
Aye.
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Miller?
Aye.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 2657. Ian Gross moved forward with the Duke pad. And Senator Starr is going to carry that one. Close the work session. And okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 9. Have no witness list here yet, but we got it on the way. We got Ed Shimizu, GTE, Shelly Jensen, David Olson, and Beth Vargas Duncan, League of Oregon Cities. All if you can.
Just because as a witness has approached, I would like to declare a potential conflict of interest in that in my legal practice. I represent businesses that are involved both in internet and in cable.
We'll recognize. Thank you.
Chairman Starr, I'm Shelly Jensen, the governmental affairs manager for GTE, and I'm just going to introduce the panel. We were asked to keep it to 10 minutes, and so Ed Shimizu from GTE will be testifying, Stephen Tafori representing the Oregon Internet Service Providers, and David Olson representing the City of Portland. I think there are some other folks who are also supportive, but they're just going to say their names on the record and that they support. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to appear today. For the record, Ed Shimizu with GTE with our headquarters in Irving, Texas. What I'd like to do today in talking about Senate Bill 9 is to give a little bit of background about this part of the business so that we're all on the same page and on the same wavelength. We can understand what we're trying to do here. Today, when a consumer in their home wants to use their personal computer to access the Internet, most people in America today are dialing up their service over existing telephone wires. It goes out, and those wires are obviously would be from companies like GTE or US West or other phone companies across this country. So they use the phone wire, and then they go out to what is called an Internet service provider. And that service provider is like a gateway into the Internet. And that company, in most cases, is not affiliated with phone company. There are literally hundreds of different Internet service providers, as Senator Bryant is well aware of, representing some of them. And what happens is it's really two distinct services that we're talking about. One is the transport of the service, of the information back and forth, and that's over the wire. And the other is the gateway that allows people to tap into literally thousands of sites across the world where they get information. And they can download tons of data information, graphics, pictures, all sorts of things from the Internet that way. There are two distinct services, and that's pretty much the way it's handled today. What's happened, however, is that the phone wire really wasn't designed to do that. It really doesn't have adequate capacity to do that on an ongoing basis. It was designed to carry voice traffic. And voice doesn't take up a lot of room on the wire, so that's why copper wire for voice worked for so many years. But now that we're getting to the Internet area, it really takes a lot of time for a lot of data and pictures and graphics to get downloaded using the existing copper wire. So there, in the last few years, there have been a number or a couple of major new technology developments. One has happened within the phone industry, something we call ADSL. And rather than get into all the details, let's just say that it's copper wire on steroids, if you will. And what it does is we use the existing wire. We don't rip it out, but we put electronics in both ends of it at the customer's home and at our central office at the switch. And that we're able to boost the capacity. And for us, it's roughly 50 times the capacity that we're able to boost it up by doing that. So it's a wonderful service. The downside is it has a limited range. We can't do it much more than, say, 3 miles from the central office. Outside of that, it sort of just doesn't work. That's just the nature of the steroids. It just can't do much more than that. So obviously, we can't cover all of our service area using ADSL service. Now, the other major advanced technology today is called the cable modem service, and that's really what this bill is aimed at. So the cable modem service is using an existing cable TV plant where they do upgrades to their plant, and they're able to do two-way broadband traffic. And the problem that's occurring here is not so much the technology, because the technology works very well. When they do it properly, they're able to boost their capacity 100 times over the existing phone wire that's in our homes today. So it's a very good service. What's happening is the way that they're marketing it is they are bundling their service. So they have the transport part, which is what we're doing, and then they have an Internet service provider that's affiliated with the cable operator. And they're selling it to their consumers as a package, and they tell them that's the way that you get it from us. You can't get it as an unbundled package. And that's exactly what Senate Bill 9 is aimed at. In the telephone environment, our lines are completely open so that anybody who wants to use our facilities to reach their customers, their Internet customers, can do that. And as a matter of fact, as a tribute to how open our networks are, America Online is, if you will, the winner of the existing Internet Derby. They've been able to sign up 17 million customers without owning hardware because phone networks have been open across this country. So using the existing model where Internet providers compete against each other, the person with the best package, with the best value, with the best marketing is the one that's winning, and so far it's America Online. So that's the value of the open network. On the cable side, it's been a closed network where they bundle the transport service along with the Internet service. And an analogy would be you take your car to a mechanic for an oil change. And you ask him, how much is it for the oil change? And he says, $19.95, I'll change your oil and I'll put in 4 quarts of my generic oil. And you tell him, well, I really want my oil changed, but I don't want your generic oil. As a matter of fact, I got 4 quarts in my trunk of what I want you to put in. How much will you charge me then? And he says, it's still $19.95. And that's kind of what Internet providers or cable operators are doing with their cable service. and their internet service and bundling it together. And that's the thing that we would like to have addressed with this bill. It would require cable operators to open their networks so other internet providers that want to use the cable modem services, advanced 100 times capacity systems, they'll be able to use that and reach their customers. And it does two things. It's pro-consumer, because consumers then, they already have an existing relationship with an internet provider such as America Online. They get to keep that relationship with America Online. They don't have to give it up. And then the flip side is for the internet providers, it's very pro-competitive because it allows any one of these internet providers to compete for the customer. So it works on both ends. I'd urge you to act favorably in this legislation at this time and not wait for another legislative session, because that's not going to roll around for another 2 years. That's because this business is growing so fast. And let me just give you some quick data here. At Home, which is the largest internet provider using the cable modem system, is owned by TCI, which in turn has just been acquired by AT&T. And in an April 13th news release, they announced that as of the first quarter of 99, they have 460,000 subscribers. What is really dramatic about it is this is a 39% increase from the previous quarter, not year. The FCC report on the same subject, talking about cable internet demand, they project growth is between 40 and 50% per quarter. Not per year, but per quarter. That's how dramatic it's growing. There's another industry analyst that says it's forced to research, and they predict by the year 2000, and that's just in a year, there are going to be between 16 and 20 million homes in the country that are going to have broadband internet connections. So if you wait a couple of years, the cart's out of the barn, so to speak, or the horse is out of the barn, because so many people are going to be locked into this closed cable system that says, if you take our cable modem service, you have to take our internet provider and lock it in that way. And once the relationship is there, it's going to be very hard for other people to come in and break it. So it's a critical issue, it's an emerging issue, and we urge you to act on it today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question? Okay, is there anything that would stop GTE from running their own cable?
We are doing it right now. That's what we call the ADSL service. Yes, we are doing that, and we, as I explained, we do have some geographic limitations. We're obviously competing against them. We're trying to compete against them. But the point I want to emphasize is our network is open, so that we do have other internet providers that are using our system.
But in part, you're open because aren't you regulated by the PUC?
Yes, we are.
And the cable company aren't.
Right, and that's why we have to come to a body such as this, the legislature, that can regulate companies throughout the state, whether or not they are regulated utilities or not.
Do you think cable companies should be regulated by the PUC?
Not by the PUC. They are a de facto monopoly, or they were built up as a de facto monopoly. In most communities across America, I think as you're pretty well aware, cable grew up as pretty much the only game in town. So much like telephone utilities, where we grew up, you had a captive rate base that helps you pay for your facilities that allow you to get it out into your communities, and that's pretty much how cable did it. So they built up their facilities to get to this point, and now they're saying this is going to be a closed system, no one else gets in our system, you play by our rules if you want to.
But on the cable end of it, as far as television reception and movies and whatever, of course they have competition now through the satellites.
Mm-hmm.
So that's no longer closed from that aspect, and if it would seem you could run them out of business if you wanted to make the investments to run your own cable, because then you wouldn't need them anymore.
Well, we are going in competition with them. The reality is that, as I said, we're not going to be in every community that they're going to be in. They've got the reach, they pass over 90-some plus percent of the homes in America with cable systems. They will have the capability to upgrade. As you look at the literature, one of the things that really brings it home is that so much of the cable industry is being consolidated, obviously, as you're well aware of reading newspapers, under AT&T. And just to go over how dramatic that is, AT&T has, in the last year, spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $130 to $150 billion in acquisitions. And that's just in the last year. I mean, it's incredible the amount of money that they've been putting out there. And they're making a major league bet on what the future is going to be. And their vision is, obviously, it's two-way broadband facilities to people's homes where they want to suck as much of household telecommunications and entertainment, video entertainment dollars that they can. And there's nothing wrong with that model. We would love to do the same thing, and we're trying to do the same thing ourselves. We're in direct competition with them. As a matter of fact, they were able to convince both the FCC and the U.S. Justice Department when they were trying to get the merger approval for the TCI deal. They were able to convince them the reason why they ought to be approved is public policy of then they'd be able to compete against phone companies. So they've already made a commitment on the record that they're going to be upgrading their facilities in direct competition with phone companies. But the model on the phone company side is we have an open network. By the 1996 Telecom Act at a federal level, we're required to open up our networks. And yes, we've had some very contentious sessions with the new entrants as they try to get in, and we feel they're overreaching and they feel we're not giving enough. I mean, you know, that's one of those things. It's a tough situation, but at the same time, it is working. People are out there. They're beginning to use our facilities to compete against us. And it's an open network in our
system. In that regard, too, is I call it stranded costs, and I realize that deals more with electricity and its delivery, but even though you're an open system, you have a right to recover your investment costs. Is that correct?
We used to pretty much have that right under what they would call rate of return regulation, but we don't have that on a federal level. We're under price caps on a federal level. In many of the jurisdictions across this country, we are also under some form of incentive regulation. So there is no automatic right of recovery anymore in most of the jurisdictions that we operate in.
And in Oregon, do you have a guaranteed rate of return?
We're rate of return here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Byers,
are you aware of any place in Oregon where your internet access through the cable is taking place now?
I was just reading an article that said that there were a couple of places that TCI and At Home were offering it, even though that there's a lawsuit this time.
Who can talk about that, Mr. Chair?
Some of these other witnesses can talk about it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Gaffori, and I'm here representing ORISPA, which is the Oregon Internet Service Providers Association, and also First World Communications, which is the internet company, which is not setting up ISP service yet, but it plans to here in the state. ORISPA is made up of about 50, mostly small internet service providers located all across the state, urban and rural areas as well. We're very supportive of this bill. I lobbied this issue in Multnomah County in Portland, where we became the first communities in the country to mandate that broadband cable be open to access. Well, we did it for two reasons. First of all, it allows us to continue in business. If you have a situation where the cable system is requiring the customers to get, for example, the at-home service, which costs about $40 a month, they're not likely to then additionally want to buy teleport on top of that because they may have all their friends know their email address, and it would be nice and convenient that they've had a good relationship with teleport, for example, or Easy Street, another one of these local internet service providers, and they'd like to support local folks. They're not going to cough up $40 and then also additionally on top of that pay for the local internet service provider. So we think it would be in deep trouble if this open access is not allowed. Secondly, we think it's important for our customers. It allows price competition. Right now, if At Home says it's going to be $40, who's around to say, well, how about we'll do it for $35? There isn't anybody, and they can pretty much, in a monopoly situation, charge what they want. Also, service competition. We've seen what's happened here without naming any names in situations where you have competition monopolies. You have to have an outside agency, a PUC, to come in and regulate service and say you're not doing this service well, you're not doing that service well. We think that that's best handled by competition. So if you have a variety of service providers, internet service providers, so you have people who will provide the service. And secondly, you have competition for new and increased services. The innovations that have occurred in this area have come from the small firms that are trying to find a new niche or a leg up on their competitors so that they can provide something that other people don't or can't, and that you only get when you have competition. There is some history on this. As we said, when U.S. West went into their DSL service, they at first did not want to have this be open access, and we worked with them, PUC, to get open access, and the result has been that it's been very profitable and very helpful for both U.S. West and for local internet service providers. It's worked out well. We think we have a model that has worked with DSL, and we'd like to see this model work with the cable.
That's it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, I'm David Olson. I'm the Cable Communications Director for the City of Portland. I have submitted written testimony for the record and would refer you to that in terms of the policy issues and some of the history of it, of this issue at the City of Portland. I'll be very brief in light of your constraints. As has been said, this is a very simple issue. And the issue is, are consumers going to have to pay twice to get their internet service provider of choice through high-speed cable modem? It's not complicated. It's really quite simple. They don't have to do that if they get their high-speed internet service through the phone company. They will have to do that if they get it through the cable company. And people are continually going to be moving toward the high-speed internet access because it's going to become more and more indispensable as the internet gets denser with multimedia content, video, graphics, those kinds of things. You must have the speed to access the latest in content. So this is an area where certainly Portland, Multnomah County took action. It's an area where the state has plenty of jurisdiction. There is nothing specifically preempting any state jurisdiction on this, and certainly for the city, we find ourselves in the unusual position of saying, yes, the state should. Very good reasons for the state to act on this and to take a leadership position on this. Open access policy is pro-competitive. It's pro-marketplace. It's pro-consumer. On the merits, head-to-head, there's virtually no substantive arguments against it that stand up. The arguments against it are legalistic, basically, in nature. We don't agree with the law on that. This is also a case where Oregon, again, could take a tremendous leadership role. The FCC has been stalemated on this, and they are actually looking to states and localities to develop a record for them in how this is to be done, and that sparked interest throughout the West Coast, Seattle, King County, Los Angeles, San Francisco area, Portland area, and FCC staff has literally said we're really looking for some common law in this to come out, and the FCC has commissioned its staff to closely monitor this issue, particularly with the concentration of ownership coming from AT&T in the cable industry. Now we're talking about a situation where the company can dominate 60% of the entire cable households in the U.S. This issue becomes even more critical and has now sparked a bill in Congress on open access, and there will be more. So there is a tremendous leadership opportunity here for the state of Oregon at a time, at a very unusual time, when the federal government and the Federal Communications Commission is actually looking for some leadership on this issue, and we're at the crest of what, in my own belief, will be one of the most significant telecommunications policy issues for the next several years. So, to that extent, we endorse Senate Bill 9. We think it's proper that the state do this. We think that meets any test you would like to find for fairness and pro-consumer and pro-business. It's a win for all concerned, and we endorse it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Seth. I have a question. Go ahead. You mentioned in our result that you didn't see a good argument opposing it. Suppose you're a small cable owner, unregulated by the PUC, and that for the last 10 years you've invested your family assets to string cable and have a business plan, and that includes offering these bundled services, and it does give you a competitive advantage, but you knew that was the law and that was your intent and that's what you've done.
and now you're in the free marketplace and you're able to offer these services on your cable network. If you were in those shoes, do you think it's fair for the state of Oregon to come in and say, well, we're going to change the rules and going to take away that competitive advantage that you've worked so hard to gain and where you took the economic risk of laying the cable?
Senator Bryant, you make a good point, but I would respond in a couple of ways. First of all, it's not at all clear that the competitive advantage you refer to is grounded in current law and is precluded from your authority or locality's authority. And all of this market has been developing just in the last couple of years. It's inconceivable that even a small operator that you refer to could have upgraded their system in the 1990s, even contemplating this even 3 or 4 years ago. That's how fast, of course, this is developing.
And I know there's a new type of cable and the technology changes, but obviously some cable companies had some vision that something was going to happen and put in a system that offers you better, faster access than the phone system.
Senator, the second part of the answer to that, I hope I'm getting your question, is that in my own view, it's not at all clear that the cable industry is going to suffer from providing both wholesale and retail access to their system. In fact, we've seen the pie grow larger in telecommunications, where you actually have more people coming onto the system because of the open access to the system. We've seen that even with AT&T itself, where their market position, which of course was 100% prior to 1982, now is perhaps in the neighborhood of 70%, and yet they're making their profits, their revenue for subscribers greater. Why? Because the pie has grown larger as more people climb onto the system. It's not at all clear that there's any adverse fiscal advantage to any cable operator from not only offering retail access to their own product, which I might add is a very good product, the cable modem, proprietary programs, Roadrunner, NetHome are really very good products. However, it's through the benefits of competition and also some wholesale access that other folks are able to compete and provide these things. And it's not at all clear that the operators would suffer economically. Rather, I would argue, Senator, that the small operator you posit would benefit.
If that's the case, wouldn't they do that naturally without the need of the legislation? They see that economic gain?
One would hope, Senator. However, there is a developing market right now as this is launching and as the demand is increasing for Internet service now, and it's escalating every day and every minute. And there is a tremendous market opportunity for the cable industry to be first to market with a widely penetrated high-speed cable modem and to establish dominance in that market before the open access requirements come in, as indeed, in my own opinion, I believe they must come in if the current language of federal telecom law has any meaning at all. But by being first to market and designing their systems in a proprietary way, it will take much, much longer to apply open access to the systems after the fact than now when it's beginning. And so the time to act really is now because it's going to be much more difficult later. And I personally believe the open access to cable modem is simply inevitable. You can't have the kind of language you have in current law about competition and still keep these proprietary.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dove Vargas Duncan. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities does represent 238 cities statewide. I'll be very brief. I just want to say that this legislation before you, Senate Bill 9, is very timely, as has aptly been described already, and that the League supports competition in the telecommunications cable arena, and we also believe this legislation is very good public policy. We urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will invite Dwayne Bosworth on. Aaron? Mike Dewey? I believe that's anyone else plan to testify?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Mike Dewey with the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. As you might imagine, we have a different view of how competition is going to evolve in the few years to come. We have about 10 minutes with you, and we hope we can stay within the confines of that 10 minutes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bosworth is representing AT&T, and he will speak first about the bill and the concerns that we have. Mr. Wren is with Falcon Cable and Medford, and thank him for coming up. And they are getting into the high-speed data business, and he'll talk a little bit about the problems that this bill would have for them. And then at the end, I'll take a few minutes, if we have those few minutes, to discuss the model of competition and why we think this bill is kind of wrong-headed, if you will.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dwayne Bosworth. I'm an attorney with Davis Wright from Maine. I represent AT&T and TCI. I have been involved in these very issues of open access since they arose here approximately 6 months ago. And I have three points to make in the short time that we have. First is that with all due respect, this is a matter which is preempted by federal law. And despite the white paper that's been presented to you today, the law is quite clear that, in fact, as I will describe to you, this is a matter for the FCC and for Congress, and it is not a matter that the state should be involved in or can be involved in. The second point that I would add is that this is a matter that the FCC has studied in great length, and here we are on May 20th attempting to with very, very little testimony, consider the facts of this matter. This is, in fact, Senate Bill 9 is a solution in search of a problem, as I will describe. And finally, I would point out that this Senate Bill 9 would result in a regulatory nightmare were it to pass. So let me be very brief and put this in context. I should remind us that though Mr. Kafori referred to Portland and Multnomah counties as the first jurisdictions to require open access. In fact, in the United States, they are the only jurisdictions to require open access. Of approximately 960 jurisdictions which passed on the AT&T-TCI merger, only Portland and Multnomah in the country have asked for this requirement. Similarly, no state has imposed this requirement. It has been introduced in four states. It's absolutely dead in three states. And is on, I don't even think life support would be fair in the fourth state. And this is for a good reason, because each of these jurisdictions has recognized that, in fact, this is a matter for the federal government and for the FCC. I'll be very brief, though I could refute point by point the white paper that's been handed to you, but I think the sheer language of the federal of the federal statutes will convince you of the sound of this, that in fact, federal jurisdiction is preemptive. Section 544F1 of the United States Code states that any state may not impose requirements regarding the provision or content of cable services except as expressly provided in this title. You've not heard of anything that provides in the title in 47 U.S.C. that would ever allow this condition. Forced access, as is being urged here, is both provision of cable and is content. You have to understand that what's being asked for here is that AOL, for example, would be allowed to be forced onto the cable. You would, in fact, see AOL content, and that's quite relevant. Second, there's a very sharp distinction throughout all of the federal legislation between cable and telecom. And Section 541 of that same title states that cable is not a common carrier. And so this is very different from telecom. It is for purposes of rate of return, as you've discussed, and also for the entire scheme of regulation in this country. Telecom is completely and totally different. Cable is not a common carrier and cannot be forced to carry somebody else's message. Finally, I would state 47 U.S.C. 544E, no state may prohibit, condition, or restrict any cable operator's use of technology. GTE, the speakers here first, have told the FCC that, quote, the architecture and technology of the network planned by AT&T and TCI is not capable of supporting open access without technical modification. That is what they have told the FCC in the FCC proceedings. It is beyond question that AT&T and TCI would be required to make technological changes, and that is absolutely prohibited to be regulated by the state. We do not want in this country piecemeal regulation of this industry. I might add briefly that, in fact, there are also very, very significant First Amendment considerations here. Cable, wholly unlike telecom, is, in fact, a First Amendment speaker. And you would have here, if, in fact, you passed Senate Bill 9, a violation of the First Amendment, because you would be requiring cable providers to carry the content of AOL, of others, without their consent, and that is a very serious First Amendment issue, wholly distinct from the telecom world. Let me turn to the practical world. I think, again, I could refute in greater length the white paper that's been given to you, but the scheme of the federal legislation makes it clear that, in fact, this is a matter for Congress and the FCC. May I say that the FCC has, in fact, studied this matter in great detail. It has had two looks already, one at the time of the merger of AT&T and TCI, and also recently when it was required to report to Congress on the status of high-speed access to the Internet. In both cases, the FCC has expressly decided that it would not come forward with a requirement of open access. One of the things the FCC has pointed out time and time again is that the marketplace must, in fact, decide this. And it's the FCC who has studied this, who has pointed to a number of alternatives, even in the high speed, let alone in the DSL and in the regular telecom access to the Internet. There are any number of alternatives that are out there in the future that the marketplace is going to sort out. There is wireless high-speed access to the Internet. There is satellite high-speed access to the Internet. The electric company may easily be able to provide high-speed access to the Internet. The FCC, in its wisdom, and it has had time to study the facts of this matter, has expressly decided that it would not impose the condition that you're urged to impose today. I would add that were this condition imposed, it would greatly slow the investment in this state for the provision of high-speed access to the citizens of this state. There is no marketplace sense in providing this, as Mr. Huen will discuss in just a moment. And consumers, in fact, have been slowed in their access in Portland and Multnomah, where this matter, unfortunately, is under litigation. The final matter I would say is that the bill, as it's presented, would be a regulatory nightmare. It has very straightforward, simple language with regard to providing at least as favorable rate terms and conditions. Well, we know from the telecom world, and as Mr. Schmuse himself said, there have been extraordinarily contentious sessions in the telecom world. That is what you would have here with regard to rates and with regard to technology. This would be, you would have to, I don't want to speculate, you would have to extraordinarily expand the staff of the PUC to decide who gets on to the, there are 5,000 to 10,000 IS for Internet service providers in the country. Should each one of them want to get on to any one of these cables, somebody's going to have to decide who gets on. The question of who pays what is not as straightforward as the simple language of this bill, and the technology involved in trying to get people on is extraordinarily complicated, and that's what Congress created, a huge tribunal for telecom. You would have to create a huge tribunal under the PUC in order to handle this. Thank you. We are very opposed to Senate Bill 9.
Thank you. I'm going to interrupt the progress here a moment to take some testimony from Representative Mannix. I'm going to recess the hearing on Senate Bill 9 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2585. Representative Mannix, you have no doubt met with the previous witness. And
yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Mannix from Salem. I appreciate your hearing. House Bill 2585. I have had a conversation with L. Patrick Hearn, the Executive Director of the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and he had shared with me some of the Commission's suggestions and concerns in regard to this legislation. I don't know if you have a copy of his correspondence or not. I will mention to you that what the specific concerns are, but first I'll tell you that what this bill is designed to do is to avoid a strict liability situation in terms of some interpretation in the case law as to the disclosure of conflict of interest and the nature of conflict of interest.
The strict liability is this: even if you don't know about a conflict of interest, it's been interpreted that you better disclose it. And this bill changes that to say that if you knew or reasonably should have known of the conflict or the potential conflict, then you have the obligation to disclose. It's been a long day. And I don't think there's any real controversy about that part of this bill. And another part, the question is, how often do you keep telling people about the nature of the conflict? You announce the existence of the conflict, you describe the nature the first time under this bill. If you're going through business at a particular meeting and it comes up several times, you don't have to keep repeating what the nature of the conflict is. There is some clarifying language which would be necessary to accomplish that, which I'll get into in a moment. But the basic idea is, in a lot of councils and commissions and boards, folks are sitting around, they're working on something back and forth, and they may have a long meeting, and this item may come up several times. And technically, under the current statute, every time it comes up, you have to declare that you have a conflict and explain the nature of the conflict. This would allow you to declare the conflict and explain the nature at the beginning of this, say, long meeting, and each time it comes up, mention again, well, I have a conflict, and say, as a amendment here, if anyone wants, I'll disclose the details of the nature of the conflict. It's designed to reduce a little bit the strict standards, but at the same time, meet the needs of the system to make sure citizens are aware of conflicts or potential conflicts of interest involving appointed and elected officials. This does not affect members of the Legislative Assembly. The bill is amended so that we don't address that issue. That whole conflict issue for legislators is now handled separately in any event. The suggestions from the Standards and Practices Commission were that, as to a minor point on page one of the AIM Gross bill, if you're explaining the nature of the conflict, they suggested that ought to be in writing, since also presenting the conflict is supposed to be in writing. That's at line 16 of page 1. I agree with that. So it would say the official shall explain the nature of the conflict, comma, in writing, comma, upon request of the appointing authority. I think that that was the intent, and I think it should be clear. There's also a concern at page 2, line 11, if you're announcing the existence of the conflict and you don't have to explain it unless someone asks, they've suggested that you should also mention that you're available to explain it. It's saying, well, I want to reiterate that I have a conflict or a potential conflict in this matter, and I'm available to explain it if someone requests. That way, the members of the public who are in attendance will understand that they can make that request. The reason why this will save some time is sometimes it takes several minutes to explain what's going on with a conflict. Sometimes it may only take a few seconds, but this way you can just say you're available to explain it. If somebody wants to ask you about it, you can go into the explanation. Finally, the Standards and Practices Commission suggested that there is a need for some clarification language on page 2, lines 13, 14, and 15. Their point is that the bill as presented says you can declare the conflict and the nature the first time you deal with the subject matter, and then you don't need to bring it up again. Their point is that we ought to clarify that every time you're going back into another meeting and it comes up, the first time during that meeting, you ought to present that information so that at that meeting there is a fresh start as to that. And I have no problem with that suggested amendment, and we'd be happy to work with staff to have those clarifying amendments added to this bill. And I'm sure Mr. Hearn would be happy to help with that, too. The thrust of this, though, the most important part of the bill, the strict liability provision, it bothers me to think that someone doesn't know that they've got a conflict or reasonably couldn't be held to have known, and yet they would be held strictly liable right now for a failure to disclose a conflict, and again, or a potential conflict. And that's the heart of this bill. I certainly would encourage its passage. And I would mention that I don't personally have any clients who have any issues pending before the Standards and Practices Commission, so I have no conflict of interest myself.
Unless there's something out there you should have disclosed, you failed to disclose, and you've got a severe problem.
Well put, Senator Bryant. Thank you very much.
Questions? Mr. Chair, the other bill I questioned Mr. Hearn on is separate from this. It's Representative Williams' bill that codifies the Attorney General's opinion. And both of these work nicely together in tandem. So at some point, I don't know where that bill is. I know it's had a hearing, but and from the look on your face,
I don't either.
But I'll find out in the chair of the committee where that bill is.
Thank you. And
we'll work with staff and get those amendments. We'll bring this bill back and move it on its way.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the courtesy.
Thank you. With that, we close the public hearing on House Bill 2585, and we return from recess on the hearing on Senate Bill 9.
Chair Starr, members of the Senate Rules Committee, my name is Ron Rand. I'm the Divisional Vice President for Falcon Cable Communications. Falcon is a cable company that operates in 38 states, and we specialize in cable systems for small rural communities. Here in Oregon, my responsibilities include 150,000 customers. However, that is represented by 50 franchising authorities that we service throughout the state of Oregon. I am also representing the Oregon Cable Television Association, and we are opposed to SB 9 for a number of reasons. A number of Oregon cable companies have already provided broadband internet services to customers within their franchise areas, and a number are planning to do so. At Falcon Cable, my company, we have signed an agreement with At Home to provide cable modems and high-speed data services to the residents of Oregon beginning June of this year. We're in the process of upgrading over 1,100 miles of our existing fiber network in Josephine and Jackson County alone. And that process is going underway, and we're looking forward to getting into the high-speed internet business. If SB 9 were to become law, we would be required to provide access to any internet service provider that warranted access to our private telecommunications network. I can assure you that my company and other local Oregon cable companies would not have made investments to offer high-speed data services if we were forced to open our proprietary networks to all newcomers. And I must point out that 1,100 miles of plant that we're building just in Josephine and Jackson County is at a cost of millions and millions of dollars. It's a very, very capital-intensive business. I will not reiterate the legal reasons why I would believe the Oregon legislature does not have the authority to impose requirements on cable companies like ours. Both the FCC and Congress have looked at this issue, and they've decided to leave it alone. My remarks will center on why SB 9 creates poor public policy. Almost everyone agrees that competition in the local telecommunications marketplace has a lot of merit. Competition will allow customers choice of service providers and usually translates into lower rates. Cable companies can be another choice for the consumer in the telecommunications marketplace because of our system that we have in place. But make no mistake about it, the proponents of SB 9 desire to slow down facility-based competition like the competition we're bringing to the Rogue Valley and throughout the state of Oregon. Our investments in cities throughout the country are spurring others to upgrade their network. That said, the cable industry is in its early stages of deploying broadband facilities. Substantial investments have been made on the basis that government won't interfere with our opportunity to compete. We know of Oregon cable companies that want to develop partnerships with other telecommunications businesses, but on their terms, not under a government edict. AOL, or American Online, has about 17 million customers nationwide, while the whole cable industry has 500,000 customers that are currently receiving internet access through cable modems. Another point is that SB 9 is unnecessary because there are presently a number of different ways to access the Internet, as been talked about earlier, and also reach other internet service providers. In addition, SB 9 will create a very, very real technical problems in being able to accommodate the 6,000-plus service providers that may ask for access to our networks. We clearly would need to reconfigure our head end, which is our processing center, to accommodate all providers, with the likely result of decreasing speeds on our network. The reason we believe our network will be successful is because our customers want very high speeds, and by having a seamless, somewhat unbundled approach, we can offer those very, very high speeds. In addition, since our network operates, and this is a very important point, we do not have unlimited capacity. Our cable modem operates on a 6 megahertz bandwidth, and clearly we have limited bandwidth, and if we were to open our networks, we would have to take a hard look at the amount of television signals that we have going down our cable plant. So, I mean, we're upgrading our plant to get more bandwidth, but it's not unlimited. If SB 9 becomes a law, the result would be an administrative nightmare if we had an open access system. Dockets would be necessary to deal with both the cost and the technical issues, and as a result, the deployment of broadband facilities would be further delayed. Our request, and I encourage you, to allow the marketplace to work and to not move on this for sale. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Mike Dewey, Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I will be brief. I thought one of the comments from the proponents was excellent, that AT&T was taking a major league bet on the amount of money that they're spending in an area that heretofore has not been very profitable. That is the high-speed data business, and spending just literally billions of dollars. And if that is the case, if it's a high-speed bet, I would argue that you don't need to regulate it. The marketplace will take care of that. But clearly, they've made that bet believing that the cable plant and the broadband plant will work for them. They don't know, and we don't know. Our product is more expensive than AOL. It's $20 more on average. How many people want to take that over time? We don't know. We think it's going to be a good business down the road. We have 2% of the business. I find it very ironic that people want to regulate a business that has 2% of the business. There was discussion about the breakup of AT&T, and they had 100% of the business. Well, I can understand that. They want to break up AT&T today with 2% of the business. I think it's a wrong approach. We have cable companies, as Mr. Wren talked about, small cable companies. Crestview Cable, for example, in Prineville and Madras this summer plans to provide high-speed data services. And their partner is not at home, it's not Roadrunner, it's the IFT channel, another provider. Ben Cable has said that they want to partner with anybody who's willing to partner who can make a good deal. And they look at it from 3 to 5 years out because the technology is going to change. Mr. Bosworth talked about the dockets. Clearly, what would happen is the competition would be stifled if this goes to place. And the reason being is you've got 6,000 ISP providers that might want access. Obviously, you can't provide access to all of those technically. So at that point in time, we basically have a stay until we deal with the rules and regulations. And based on what's happened with the PUC in the past, that's a 2 to 3 year process. But for those who want competition and are promoting this bill, I think, in fact, they're delaying competition. And our goal, and I think this legislative goal, is to promote competition in the local exchange, and that is in part one of the reasons AT&T is doing that, not only to provide high-speed services, but to down the road provide telephony, which is a very difficult business to deal with. So we think at this point in time, Senate Bill 9 should not pass, and the marketplace should be allowed to work. So we hope this bill does not move forward. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I appreciated the discussion. It's an issue, I think, that's broader and deeper than we're going to be able to plumb this late in the session. As much as I love to get into the tough issues.
It's a tough one.
In which my friends are on both sides of the issue. It will not go away. And I think that we will have future opportunities. But I scheduled this for hearing only so that I wouldn't be terribly motivated to move ahead at this point. And I'm really appreciative, more appreciative of the problems that you're confronting us with, having heard the testimony. But I've talked to some of my members, and
I'm rather convinced that we have neither the time nor the inclination to work this any further. And so with that, I thank you for your time and for bringing this to me, for the opportunity to be further educated about a growth industry. And I mean that. It is important that we be involved in policy decisions we ultimately may be forced to make. So, again, I thank everyone. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing and
thank you.
Close the committee on rules and elections.